From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. The first successful English colony in America was at Jamestown, Virginia, a swampy island on the edges of the Chesapeake Bay. The colony endured for almost a century. Even today, you can see its ruins and walk where Captain John Smith and Pocahontas walked. But Jamestown is now threatened. Scientists say rising sea levels could submerge the island by century's end. NPR's Christopher Joyce has the story of how climate change could erase part of America's history.
In springtime, Jamestown is a carpet of bright new grass. There's oak and loblolly pine, and the James River lies on every horizon. Beneath a towering stone monument, a young woman in a woolen smock and peasant blouse greets a gaggle of tourists.
Will I be Mary Buck, Mistress Buck by name? They had me to come here into town to greet ya.
Mary Buck is actually Rebecca Serdick, a Jamestown living history interpreter.
Well, thank heavens you're here where God intended you to be, right here at Jamestown in the year 1607.
Serdick engages the crowd in a tutorial about Jamestown.
How many ships was there? Three. Do you know the names of those ships, young man, over here?
These ships reached America before the Mayflower did. They were sent by the Virginia Company of London. The colonists weren't planning to build a nation, just make money and keep the Spanish out.
This island fit the bill. Militarily speaking, it's a very good place to be. The water here be very deep, and you can defend yourself.
But now it's that water that threatens to destroy Jamestown. A warming climate heats the oceans and makes them expand. Melting glaciers and ice sheets add more water. The result, the sea level is rising. Climate scientists say it could rise 2 or 3 feet by 2100, maybe more. Coastal flooding will increase, and eventually, without human intervention, Jamestown could go under. So here's what archaeologists are wondering. Can they save the island as a real place where people can step back through time and see where it all started? The National Park Service owns part of Jamestown. I meet the service's Dorothy Geyer at the new visitor center. Hurricane Isabel flooded the old one in 2003. Geyer tells me the Park Service has been thinking about flooding for a long time.
We always knew that the island was at some point going to be in danger of being covered over, but we were thinking it's another 100 years, 150 years. You know, it could be much closer.
Most of Jamestown is just above sea level. Along the shore, you can see the river invading through the tall grass. Storm surge reaches farther inland now. But there's something else unusual going on here. As sea level and the James River rise, river water pushes through the soil and underneath the island. Eventually, water under the island rises up to the surface. So water is invading Jamestown from above and below. And archaeologists know that the ground is riddled with things the colonists and Native Americans left behind. Water could ruin them. Cheryl Mays is with Preservation Virginia, which owns part of the island. She walks me around the colonists' original fort. What's left are just post holes, but archaeologists have reconstructed the wooden frame.
It's a wonderful place for a fort. You can see down the river. You can see what's the enemy coming up the river.
It wasn't until 1996 that archaeologists discovered the fort's foundation. Since then, they've recovered some 2 million artifacts, as well as grave sites. Mays says sea level rise gives the work a new sense of urgency.
It's truly in America. It is the birthplace of America. This is where it all started.
And you can still see what parts of the colony actually looked like. Like the stone ruins of the colony's original glass-making factory down by the river. And there's a replica of the factory, where glassblowers still make goblets the old-fashioned way through a metal tube.
My name is Ron Rogers. I am a glassblower. What makes us significant and the reason we're here today is because this was the first industry tried or attempted in the New World.
Hurricane Isabel flooded the glass factory in 2003. Rogers fears a rising sea means more floods.
I think about it on a weekly basis, and the ruins are that much closer to the river. If we get another one of those, it could possibly wash away the history here.
And that's the big dilemma at Jamestown. Should archaeologists dig up everything now? The Park Service's Dorothy Geyer says that's not what archaeologists have been doing here. Normally, they leave some artifacts in the ground on purpose.
So that for future generations, if there's more science and understanding about the site, they could come back and look at the site again and maybe come up with new conclusions, new stories.
That doesn't sit well with Beverly Strobe. She's an archaeologist with Preservation Virginia. I find her in the Jamestown Vault, a warren of rooms where machines buff and clean artifacts they've dug up. Strobe says leaving them in the ground could mean they'll be submerged.
Doesn't really apply here, you know, with what we see is going to happen. I mean, that would be really irresponsible to do that now, I think.
Strobe says even in a box, these artifacts tell stories the history books might not.
It's reflecting everything about their lives, you know, from straight pins to weaponry to the food they're eating to games they're playing.
What kind of games did they play?
Dice, quite a bit. Betting, sort of gambling games. Here.
Oh, this miniature dice.
Yeah, and you know why? Because dicing was illegal.
She's got thousands of objects spread out on big tables here. A child's silver whistle. Clay pots the Indians made for the colonists with flat bottoms so they'd sit on wooden tables. There's a gold ring.
Can you see what's on it?
Skull.
And it says memento mori around the outside. It's think of death.
A chilling thought, given that Jamestown archaeologists recently found the skeleton of a teenaged girl believed to be the victim of cannibalism at the hands of starving colonists in 1609. Strobe shows me a small brass rendering of an Indian's face. She says the colonists gave it to Chief Powhatan to guarantee safe passage to his messengers.
And we know that Powhatan had a comparable object. It was a chain of pearls that he gave the governor here. He said, if ever you send a messenger from you, make sure he's wearing this. So I know that the message is coming right from you.
Have you found it?
No, no.
Is it something you'd like to find?
That'd be very cool, yeah. It wouldn't surprise me at all that something like that would be found.
If there's time. To find out how much time there might be, I visit Carl Hirschner, a climate scientist at the Virginia Institute for Marine Science.
Right here, we're standing on the York River. If you look right across the way, that's Yorktown. That's where the Revolutionary War was fought and all of that.
Hirschner says coastal sites here in Tidewater, Virginia may go under faster than elsewhere because many are actually sinking. When the massive glaciers that covered much of North America retreated 10,000 years ago, some regions bounced back up. Others, like Tidewater, continue to settle. Pumping groundwater out of the ground has also caused land to settle.
We're one of those states that actually needs a nice series of disasters to keep the attention focused on what the change needs to be. That may sound pretty cynical, but that's sort of been the record.
The National Park Service is studying its options for all its vulnerable sites. For Jamestown, it could be levees and seawalls. The service is also monitoring how fast the water is rising. Saving the island would cost a lot, money the Park Service doesn't have. Short of something miraculous, Hirschner says, Jamestown may not last into the next century.
It'll be a hole in the ground, a hole in the water, with an old fort and a well at the bottom of it.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. In South Africa, just this year, more than 290 rhinoceros have been slaughtered. That's a record pace, about two rhinos killed each day. And poachers have gone high-tech, using helicopters, silencers, and night vision goggles. The killings are driven by global economic change. Demand for rhinos' horns is rising in East Asia as more people there become wealthy. We're going to hear about poaching in Africa in the next few days. But first, NPR's Frank Langfitt takes us to Vietnam, where an economic boom could threaten the rhino's survival.
A poacher takes aim at a rhino as it shades itself beneath a tree in a South African game reserve and fires. The poacher was so brazen, he actually videotaped this kill last year. A warning, what follows is very upsetting to hear. As the rhino tries to escape, it begins to cry. The poacher fires again and again until the rhino falls on its side and dies. Another scene. Yes, the poachers kept videotaping. Shows the South African hunters and Southeast Asian wildlife traffickers counting stacks of money to pay for the horn. Steve Galster got the videotape from authorities in South Africa. Galster works for the Bangkok-based Freeland Foundation, which battles wildlife trafficking.
They'll be buying this horn for tens of thousands of dollars in South Africa and selling some sets of horns over in Southeast Asia for up to $1 million.
conservationists say much of the rhino horn ends up here in Vietnam. Right now I'm standing in Hanoi in front of the old French Opera House, and if you look across the street, you can see a Gucci boutique. It's kind of a sign of the times and an indication of how much demand there is for luxury goods, including rhino horn.
The smuggling of rhino horn has been on our radar since about 2006.
Douglas Hendry works with Education for Nature, a Vietnamese non-governmental organization. He says demand for rhino horn here has been driven by sudden wealth and medicinal misinformation, including internet rumors that it can cure cancer.
The biggest values associated with rhino horn consumption in Vietnam were consumption for status and general health, for preventative medicine, treatment of cancer, the side effects of chemotherapy and things like that, detoxification, dealing with hangovers. There was a list of about 30 other medical ailments that some people believe that rhino horn was good for treating.
Hendry says rhino horn is now a status symbol.
Like a fad, it's become popular, it's the thing to do, it's gifted, which is what a great gift for your boss or your government official or something.
That's how Bui Tan got his stash of rhino horn. He's a retired official who used to approve construction projects in the Vietnamese government. Bui began taking rhino horn to recover from drinking binges with contractors.
If I didn't drink, they'd force me to. By drinking, I showed enthusiasm for future cooperation. Every time I drank alcohol, I'd go home and grind the horn and drink it. An hour later, I'd throw up and feel sober again.
Bui's 65 and the grandfather of two. He's wearing a blue and white striped polo shirt and jeans. Sitting at his breakfast table, he unwraps a piece of newspaper to reveal a small gray block of rhino horn he received as a gift. Bui pours water into a specially made bowl with a rough bottom and grinds some of the horn into a milky white liquid. It smells like burned hair, which makes sense. Rhino horn mostly contains keratin, the main component in fingernails and hair. Bui says that as the value of rhino horn grew, it became a kind of currency.
People use rhino horn as gifts to trade for a better job or trade for some benefits. That is a gift, not bribery. That's one of the reasons why the price of rhino horn has risen many times. For example, this piece used to cost $100 in the past. Now it costs $1,000.
Rhino horn prices are so high, some medicine shops sell fake rhino horn made from buffalo horn. Again, Bui.
Nowadays, some people even have the technology to make rhino horn from industrial plastic, and it's destructive to people's health. If people want to buy rhino horn, they have to buy from trusted sources.
Actual demand for rhino horn is hard to gauge, but Ba Chang, a porcelain-making village outside Hanoi, offers some clues. This is where Mr. Bui, the government official, bought his rhino grinding bowl. Nguyen Thi Le Hong owns a factory here that makes them. That's me, bumping into some of the porcelain that blankets her shop floor. Nguyen says when she started, some of her best customers were hard-drinking pilots.
I used to sell 2,000 grinding bowls a month to the airport. Most pilots are men. They are not very careful with their belongings, and they break the bowls all the time.
Last year, Nguyen says, she sold 10,000 bowls.
My name is Naomi Doak, and I'm the coordinator of the Traffic Southeast Asia Greater Mekong Program, based in Hanoi.
Traffic is a global organization that tracks the wildlife trade. Doak says no other country has a grinding bowl industry like Vietnam's. And she says the rhino horn trade flourishes because there isn't a lot of enforcement.
Here's something that is high profit and low risk. If you get caught, you might get a fine, you might get a slap on the wrist. That's it.
Vietnam insists it strictly prohibits the illegal trade in wild animals. And last year it signed a memorandum of understanding with South Africa to cooperate on the issue. Conservationists think the key to reducing demand here, though, is education. Nguyen Quan works in the Wildlife Crimes Unit of Education for Nature. He uses public awareness campaigns to debunk rhino horn myths.
We talk with people about rhino horn and that the rhino horn is no effect at all. Rhino horn is not a magical medicine. We have kind of the banner saying that rhino horn and the people nail is not different. So instead of using rhino horn, why don't we just chewing our nail?
South Africa is home to more than 20,000 rhinos, the vast majority of the global rhino population. Getting people in Vietnam to focus on a creature so far away isn't easy. Bui, the government official who took rhino horn for hangovers, said protecting the animal isn't his problem.
It should be the responsibility of the South African government. It can't be Vietnam's. In Vietnam, if people have money, they have the right to buy it.
Some rhino horn users, though, seem to be having a change of heart. A woman named Zung, who works in international trade, said she used to take rhino horn as a general health tonic, but over time found it didn't do much, so she stopped using it. Now, she feels guilty.
I bought this horn a very long time ago, about 7 years ago, and since then I've heard a lot about rare and precious animals being killed. I feel really sorry about that and wouldn't buy any animal products again.
How many other rhino horn users here are coming to the same conclusion is anyone's guess, but the rhino horn's survival may depend on it. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
This is NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Earth's atmosphere is entering a new era. A research station in Hawaii has been tracking average daily carbon dioxide levels for more than half a century. And now, that level has reached a milestone, 400 parts per million. That number is one of the clearest measures of how human beings are changing the planet. It shows how much carbon we've put into the air from burning fossil fuels, carbon dioxide that drives global warming. NPR's Richard Harris has our story.
Back in 1958, Dave Keeling started measuring carbon dioxide levels from Mauna Loa, Hawaii, a remote volcano where the air is free of local influences. His first measurement showed carbon dioxide levels at 313 parts per million. And over the lifetime of his son, Ralph Keeling, the number has now reached a big, round number, 400 parts per million.
Of course, there's no real planetary threshold at 400. It's a psychological threshold.
Keeling took over the monitoring project at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography after his pioneering father died in 2005.
It does feel like we're moving from the past into the future at this juncture. It's one of these milestones where, like the change of a millennium, you know you're going to get there, or pretty sure you're going to get there, but you always think of it as being off in the future, and now here we are moving into what feels like another era.
Keeling says a daily reading of 400 parts per million really marks the beginning of a transition that will play out over several years.
The atmosphere doesn't have completely uniform carbon dioxide concentrations. It oscillates up and down with season, and on average it's a little higher in the northern hemisphere. And what we're seeing now is the beginnings of flickers up towards 400 parts per million at the iconic Mauna Loa record.
And what does this mean? The physical meaning of the number is quite straightforward.
Out of a million air molecules, 400 are carbon dioxide.
That's 0.04%. That small number packs a big punch. That amount of carbon dioxide can trap a great deal of heat in our atmosphere. In fact, the planet would be frozen solid if we didn't have any carbon dioxide in the air.
Lots of things that are present in small amounts can have big impacts. I mean, you think about blood cholesterol or anything else.
And more to the point, these levels have increased rapidly.
These are not small changes in percent terms. 2-3 million years ago was the last time we ever had concentrations in this range. So we're moving into territory that's almost outside the scope of human existence on the planet at this point.
And this enormous change has actually occurred during the careers of today's senior Earth scientists. Take, for example, Richard Houghton at the Woods Hole Research Center.
Well, I graduated from high school in 1961, near the beginning of this record, and concentration then was just a little over 315 parts per million. I came to Woods Hole in 1975, and it was then somewhere between 325 and 330. By year 2000, concentration was over 360.
And the pace of change is actually accelerating.
Under business as usual, it's heading to over 600 parts per million. It could go up to 800 parts per million.
That's by the end of this century. And of course, there's nothing magical about the year 2100 that would stop the trend at that point. Houghton has spent a chunk of his career trying to understand how the planet has dealt with all that carbon dioxide. It turns out that only half of the carbon dioxide that we've put into the air by burning fossil fuels has actually stayed in the air, though it will remain there for centuries. The other half has been soaked up by the oceans, trees, soils, vegetation, and so on. But Houghton says we shouldn't assume that nature will be able to keep this up forever. For one thing, as the oceans warm, their ability to soak up carbon dioxide will slow.
My guess is that at some point the take-up of carbon by oceans and land will first level off and then actually decline. And it's possible you could have a reverse so that nature, instead of absorbing carbon dioxide, is releasing it. And then we're in big trouble in terms of managing carbon cycle.
And ask Ralph Keeling at what level we start to get into trouble from climate impacts?
It's a little hard to say, but certainly I'm among those who think that if we really wanted to be prudent about this, we shouldn't have let it go over about 350, so we're already into dangerous territory.
And now, reaching 400 parts per million, we're heading deeper into the unknown. Richard Harris, NPR News.
There is, of course, a history of social activism on many college campuses in this country. We're now going to hear about a current campaign to battle climate change that's borrowing from strategies of the past. Students at more than 300 colleges in the United States are asking their school's endowment fund to distance themselves from any coal-producing companies. NPR's Elizabeth Shogun reports.
Divest coal. That's what Brown students are asking their university to do. Dump coal stocks. Emily Kirkland is a senior at Brown. I reach her cell phone as she marches through her campus in Providence, Rhode Island.
This is our fourth rally.
Have you made any progress?
Absolutely. So our administration is taking us very seriously.
Kirkland and about a dozen other students at Brown got the idea for their campaign in September from a Rolling Stone article by climate activist Bill McKibben. They could do what students of earlier generations did. In the 1980s, students outraged by South Africa's racist apartheid system got their universities to drop stock in the companies that did business with that government. In the 1990s, student activists did the same with Big Tobacco. It's called divestment. This time, students are rallying against a mainstay of the economy, big oil and coal companies. Kirkland majors in environmental studies, so she knows a lot about climate change.
It was always something that felt abstract and academic until this year. When I started to witness the heat wave in the Northeast last winter, the wildfires in the West, the drought, Hurricane Sandy, it has started to feel like there's an emergency happening in slow motion, and it has started to feel really, really personal.
The idea has taken off at about 300 colleges and universities. Four small colleges already have decided to stop investing in companies that mine coal or drill for oil. At Brown, Kirkland and other student activists are focusing only on companies that mine coal and produce electricity from it.
It's been really exciting for me to feel like this is the first time where I've seen how I can directly make a difference on my campus and force my administration to make a decision that could have reverberations around the country.
Brown has an advisory panel on responsible investments. That committee considered the students' request and after 9 months decided it agreed with them. Faculty member Chris Boole chairs the panel.
What was decided was that mining and burning coal causes grave social harm, and that the committee did not believe that it was good for Brown to be party to that.
Boole says only a tiny portion of Brown's endowment is invested in these big coal companies, so it wouldn't be a big financial hit. So far, fossil fuel companies don't seem to be paying much attention to the students' campaigns. If Brown goes ahead and divests in coal companies, Duke Energy is one of the companies that will be off bounds for investment. Duke provides electricity in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Florida, and the Carolinas. Duke wasn't aware of the campaigns, but company spokesman Tom Williams says Duke has reduced its carbon emissions in recent years. He also says although Duke's stock is thriving, the company doesn't want to lose any investors, especially not through a public divestment.
People considered the brand of Duke as an asset, and I would agree with that completely. If people see that the brand is somehow eroded in a meaningful way, that definitely can impact our stock.
That's what climate activist Bill McKibben is hoping for. In the meantime, he says, the student activists are changing their peers' minds.
What's amazing is just to see it all bubbling up from 1,000 different directions. I mean, they're taking complete charge of all of this, and that's as it should be.
And all that work they're doing is turning some of them, like maybe Emily Kirkland, into the environmental leaders of the next generation.
The divestment campaign at Brown was really the first time that I'd gotten involved in activism, and it's now something that I know I want to be doing for a long time because I've seen that it's powerful and I know that it's one of the most important things I could be doing right now.
Kirkland has a job lined up as a climate change activist after she graduates later this month. The earliest Brown could make a decision is around graduation day. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
If you're interested in what's happening to the planet that you live on, you might want to keep an eye on this measurement, which is linked to efforts to track climate change. It is the number of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. The daily average for that number is just past 400, which is the highest it's been in the modern age. And to get an accurate measurement, scientists had to put their CO2 analyzer far from cities or farms that could distort the readings. So they chose a spot in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Last week, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca visited Mauna Loa Atmospheric Observatory and has this report.
The Mauna Loa volcano is on the Big Island in Hawaii. Once you turn off the highway, it's a 16-mile drive on a road that climbs through an undulating field of nothing but rocks and boulders made from lava. When you reach 11,000 feet, you come upon a cluster of small buildings belonging to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. One of them has a plaque next to the door. I'm about to walk into the Keeling Building, named in honor of Professor Charles David Keeling, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, who initiated continuous CO2 measurements at this site in 1958. Inside, there are a bunch of computers and other electronic instruments humming away. In a corner of the room, NOAA atmospheric scientist Aidan Colton is closing off an airline he's just used to fill a glass flask.
We sample 24 hours a day on most of our instrumentation, but what we're most interested in is actually the extremely clean air coming down from the troposphere that's been well mixed, traveling over 2,000 miles in every direction to get here.
The troposphere is where the bulk of Earth's atmosphere resides. It's the buildup of carbon dioxide in the troposphere that has climate scientists concerned. Colton takes me outside and points to what looks like a tall antenna tower with several cables attached to it.
It's basically strapped down on all sides so that it doesn't blow away.
Get windy up here?
Yeah, it gets very windy at times. You know, we can get winds in excess of 50 miles per hour.
The air Colton analyzes comes from intake ports at the top of the 120-foot tower. Across a small parking lot from the Keeling Building is the main observatory building. Inside, there are offices, a pantry, and several laboratory rooms.
So this is the CO2 room?
Yeah, we call this the carbon cycle room. So we have a CO2 analyzer, a methane analyzer, and a carbon monoxide analyzer.
Colton sits down at a laptop next to the CO2 analyzer.
On our screen right now, we're seeing hourly values of CO2, and the last hourly value was 399.33, and, you know, early in the day we had a 400.46.
Just to be clear here, the hourly number isn't the headline. It's the daily average that's crossed 400 that's making news. Colton says daily averages are interesting, but they don't tell the whole story.
We're a long-term baseline monitoring station, so we're not interested in what happens hour to hour, day to day, even week to week.
Far more important is the long-term trend.
We don't expect CO2 as a monthly average to reach 400 until probably May of 2014.
But no matter what day or week or month you choose to say CO2 exceeded 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, the long-term trends show that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is continuing to climb, something scientists say remains a major concern. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Vermont has maple syrup, Northern California, wine. In Minnesota, it's all about the fish. Walleye fishing, to be exact. Today marks the opening of fishing season. It's usually one of the busiest weekends for the state's resort communities. But as Minnesota Public Radio's Conrad Wilson reports, this year, many of the lakes in northern Minnesota are still frozen.
On the shores of Lake Mille Lacs in central Minnesota, it finally feels like spring. But that's a bit confusing because the lake looks like winter.
Ice. Lots of it.
Rick Bruzewitz is a fisheries manager for the Department of Natural Resources. He says it would be tough to get a boat in the water in most places around the lake.
You know, we've got maybe, what do you think, 150 yards of open water, and that's just in front of a creek. When you go away from the creeks, in a lot of areas, it's still tight to shore even, or has 10 yards or 10 feet of open water.
On a typical opening day, thousands of anglers launch boats into this lake. most hoping to return with a walleye for a shoreline lunch. But maybe not this year. According to the Minnesota State Climatology Office, lakes north of the Twin Cities are approaching record late ice out dates set in 1950. Farther up the lake's shoreline is Twin Pines Resort. Here the ice comes even closer to shore. The docks are still sitting in the yard, and of course, so are the boats.
Hey, Anna, I'm calling in an order for...
Inside, resort owner Linda Eno is behind the bar ordering supplies for the season. She says the resort is usually booked solid this weekend, but now just over half the rooms are reserved.
A lot of tradition goes into opener. It's not always the best fishing, but there are families and friends and groups that have never missed an opener together.
Eno's hoping no one cancels and a few make some last-minute reservations. But with little hope for the type of fishing many anglers are accustomed to, she knows that might not happen.
After living on this lake for any extended amount of time, people know. You can't mess with Mother Nature, and there's no sense getting upset because there's not much you can do.
On the other side of Lake Mille Lacs is Terry McCoy, owner of McCoy's Inn. Earlier this week, he was finishing up construction on several new docks. McCoy says bookings are a little down for this weekend, but the rest of the season is shaping up to be a good one. Plus, he says, the fact that there's still ice on the lake is history in the making.
It'll be something special. You can tell your grandkids about it later on.
However the weekend shakes out, this much is for sure. The few places where Minnesota anglers searching out walleye can find open water are certain to be packed. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson.
This is NPR News.